Morning everyone, we're up to day six of the hearing of submissions on stage three of the proposed district plan. Welcome everybody, nice to see an audience. My name's Trevor Robbins, I'm the chair of the committee. I'll just ask people to introduce themselves.
Eric Mason, State Councillor, PLDC.
Sarah Dawson, I'm a planner and an independent hearings commissioner.
Atamari Tato, I'm Julie and Chisholm, independent planning commissioner.
Morena Greg Hill, independent hearings commissioner and a planner.
So first of all, we have the Glenorchy Community Association. Is that Mr. Glenn?
Good morning, Chair, Commissioners. I'm John Glover, appearing for as the Glenorchy Community Association. So firstly, just to say, as a community, we share the desired outcomes from this chapter. The protection of water quality, of landscape, and the heritage and cultural protection are all aspirations that, as a community, we share. And we've looked at the pre-lodged evidence and the summary of Edward Ellis and Michael Bathgate and Sarah Pickard. And we recognise and appreciate the proposed narrowing of the scope of the chapter as the rules have changed, or the proposed rules and the recommendations from council have changed along the way. And we greatly appreciate and support the provision of the more detailed information around sites within the chapter. And I think our observation is that where we're at now is much closer to the regime in Dunedin, where similar provisions apply. And that was our observation first up, was that there was far more specificity in the Dunedin district around the sites and the protections that than were originally proposed. So we very much welcome the provision of that here. We support the proposal to exclude the urban areas from the provisions of the chapter and to remove the 10 cubic metre trigger for earthworks. And those proposals provide remedy or relief to much of the matters that we submitted on. We have some concerns still about how existing rural subdivisions feature in all of this. I'm not sure if you've got ready access to the planning maps of the operative district plan, but if I just refer you at some point to planning map 9, which is the Glenorchy rural area. And when you get a chance to look at that, you'll see to the north of Glenorchy Township, there's a whole block of rural lifestyle zone properties. And I think the last dwelling capacity model I looked at showed there was provision for about 300 or 300 plus dwellings in the rural area. So in the context of some of those blocks have already been subdivided, and as part of that consent process there will have been recognition of the values that we're talking about today and measures in those consents. So we would have some concern that where you have an existing subdivision in the rural areas, that when somebody needs to maybe build a house, that we might be duplicating on the process, and we don't think that's an efficient process. And you know, I think most people expect the RMA to be in a relatively efficient process as one of its aims. And likewise, we'll have large rural lifestyle blocks that will be subdivided in future, and we would submit that at the time of subdivision, all the matters that are under consideration today are dealt with there. And that then shouldn't be a necessity to go through a second process as and when you get a consent for your platform or build your house. So that would be our submission. We would ask, you know, we haven't come up with some rules or some proposals, but we feel quite strongly that there should be a one-step process to go through in terms of subdivision that deals with the underlying issues. And if matters need to be put in covenants on titles or consent, subdivision consents, then so be it. And then looking, I'm not sure if this has been addressed, but we've tried to follow the track change in the proposals. And maybe somebody will answer it at some point, but if we're looking in the evidence of Sarah Pickard at the latest, or as I understand, the latest version of the rules that are proposed. And right down at the bottom where we have the areas talking about earthworks, and we have a proposed rule 25.5.22. It seems pretty unclear what the trigger point for those rules are and what the activity status is. So we have a table that talks about a maximum total volume, but it has an activity status in it. So we're just a little bit confused as to what's intended. So I put to you, for example, there's a presumption there that if you're undertaking earthworks above 400 metres above sea level, then there's a restricted discretionary consent required, but there's no trigger, there's no volume that my reading of the rule. So if you look at the definition of earthworks, and obviously in the area we live in, we have an awful lot of residential property above 400 metres above sea level. So if a residential landowner is digging a veggie garden, that's earthworks. So is it the intention of the rules that they would need a consent? So I've read and reread, I can't find a trigger volume. So that's the question to put is, rhetorically, is it the intention of these rules that any earthworks of any scale above 400 square metres are required to have a consent? And if that is the case, then we would submit probably that needs reconsideration.
The good news, Mr. Clark, is you're not going potty, you're not the only one to ask that question.
So hopefully it'll be answered anyway. So that's really the nub of our submission. And I'd just like to thank you for hearing us.
Thank you very much, Mr. Glover. I'll just ask Mr. Cheatham, have you got any questions, Mr. Glover? Mr. Hill?
Just one question for me. I understand the one stop shop did deal with it at some degree in the stage. How do you envisage that happening, given that often, you know, the building platform or the level of construction might not be known? But what are you suggesting, that at subdivision there should be a rule to say that all the investigation about the values need to be done?
Well, I think within an area, yes, because it's anticipated within the subdivision there's going to be roads, there's going to be drainage. So I think, you know, the threats that are identified should be addressed at a higher level within that subdivision. So if there's areas that it's inappropriate to build or there's protections required, that should be part of the consent conditions for the subdivision.
Right, so the whole investigation is done at that stage.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Glover, another suggestion made by another submitter, and to discuss it with Mr. Barthgate, is that earthworks within an approved building platform shouldn't be subject to the rules. What's your view of that as a potential way to address the concern that
if that is coupled with some sort of volume trigger, that would make sense. Otherwise, you would be coming back to whatever is the definition of earthworks, which is anything that is moving earth, if you look at the definition of the operative district plan. So if somebody is putting a drainage ditch in or doing sort of excavations for sort of stormwater drainage or things like that, so that would all be triggered. I understand that within the designated building platform, yes, but if there's landscaping and bunding or planting required, which often is as a result of consents in rural areas, then unless there is a minimum volume that's permitted, there's going to be an awful lot of consent requirements.
Commissioner Smith?
Yeah, thank you.
wondering, just referring to the schedule of values, I just wonder whether you, in your experience at Glenorchy, whether that's an accurate reflection of the values as you understand them for the Glenorchy area.
Certainly the protection of water and for clarity and pollution and sediment control, absolutely. And we totally recognise the need for protecting our ridge lines and the sort of development on the upper faces. So I would say yes, and also the provision of specific information about the sites of Diamond Lake and Mount Alfred. I think it's really, really helpful to have that set out because it provides a much greater understanding. There are a whole number of sites in the Glenorchy area that aren't detailed. So we know there's about 30 sites within the Glenorchy area that are of significance, but we don't have the information about that. I'm sure it's held in the archives and things, but it's not generally publicly promoted. And we've had a discussion around that, and we understand the reasons why it's not publicly promoted. So we just do recognise the more detail, and we support the more detail that has been provided about the sites that has been provided.
And generally speaking, is it more or less helpful to have more specific information in here? Or to
I think it is, because it provides a greater understanding of the context of the threats, I guess, to those values.
Okay. Thank you.
Just one question, Mr. Barber. You talk about these allotments north of Glenorchy that have already been subdivided maybe for a long time. I was just looking at the map and the new district plan. Some of those are in, say, a rural lifestyle or rural residential type zone, but are others just in the general rural zone. Would those historic allotments, whichever zone they're in, have building platforms that are identified on them, or?
Some that have already been subdivided will have building platforms that haven't yet been built on and will have gone through a subdivision consent. Others will just be 50-acre blocks within that zone which have an entitlement to subdivision, but that hasn't happened yet.
So there's a mix,
and you might want to grandfather those that have already been subdivided and been through a consenting process and have had platforms identified, but then we're suggesting for those that haven't yet been subdivided that there should be a one-stop shop, as Commissioner Hill has neatly put it.
All right, thank you very much.
Just a clarification following my colleague's question, just regarding the 30-odd sites you mentioned. We've had a conversation, obviously, with Carly McCartney, and the sensitive, protection of that information for sensitive reasons. Mm-hmm. Were you saying that you would want more detail on those, or were you saying that the level of detail that you've had to date through this process is sufficient?
I think we welcome and support the inclusion of the detail that's been provided to date, and we understand the reasons why more information may not be provided. And I think we just have to look to the process of as and when consents are required, then the only thing to flag, and it's a process flag, would be within council, what is the level of knowledge and expertise to respond to the consent issues around that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time and coming down from the Glenorchy.
It's always nice to get to the big city.
It's all relative.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Robertson.
Good morning, everyone. our submission this morning asks the council the following questions. Why is our land of significance to iwi, and particularly, why now? In the very early days, Maori did pass through our area on their way to collect the panamu, the greenstone, and possibly attempted to gather food. However, the bitter winters here and the lack of sun, even to this day, makes growing food here difficult. We have lived on our land, on a hill, for 32 years, and still have no winter sun and very little growth due to the severe frosts. For many, many years, there have been three Maori families only living in our area, two families in Queenstown and one in Arrowtown. Skyline opened the Kiwi Haka here concert to give our tourists a taste of the culture, and at times there were insufficient numbers of Maori in town to run their show 7 nights a week. How do I know? I have been selling New Zealand and sightseeing here in Queenstown since 1958, and I still do. With the land, in 1998, Ngāti Tahu were gifted $170 million and proceeded to purchase businesses here in Queenstown. With the land also gifted to them and the high rentals paid, they are a very highly successful business here in Queenstown. We fail to understand the need for this further money-gathering exercise. Who was the clever person who in 2020 pulled a plan out of the air so we could be told what portion of our land was of significance to iwi? When asked for evidence, which most of us have, at times the response is usually araha and love, which tells us nothing. The consultation with iwi, in our case the Ngāti Tahu, will be at the landowner's cost. In my involvement in community, I have attended many iwi meetings. They have beautiful karakias, they have pōwhiris, they have discussions, we have thinking time, and food generally concludes the days. These take a great deal longer than our average business meetings and would certainly be much more costly to the homeowners, and yet that would never even be mentioned. Our submission is our land is of significant interest to our Robertson family. Our ancestors rest here in the Queenstown Cemetery. Our great-grandfather was the first mayor, James William Robertson, over 150 years ago. He and Helen Stein of Helen Stein Brothers, the clothing merchant, were having a beer in the pub and discussing Queenstown definitely needed a mayor. So they decided they'd toss a coin. Head, Granddad's got it. Tails, Helen Stein did. Granddad won. Now, he was a boat builder and he built the Antrim. He then skippered the Ben Lomond, the Mountaineer, and with his son skippered the Earnslaw. Our large family is still working and volunteering here in Queenstown. Last year, our Mayor Jim Bolt planted a tree in the gardens to honour our great grandfather. Our council holds on record and verifies our family details plus our large community involvement. Now, as an aside, because when I started to read what iwi were hoping, I had a possible scenario. As one of my side thoughts, Robertson ancestors actually owned half of Thompson Street, which has got about 7 or 8 reasonably healthy sections on it. However, he was short of money for a bottle of whiskey, so he sold the land for £500. Now, theoretically, does that mean that the council would consider that a mistake and that it could be of significant interest to the Robertson family, and that any time a person decided on those 7 or 8 sections, we may need to consult with the Robertsons, and then we could be paid a little gratuity if this kind of a policy applies. If someone else has an interest in the land and something went wrong somewhere, well, it's not a very nice thought, is it? And seriously, though, we do not wish this money gathering exercise to continue. We purchased our land 32 years ago, and we did not appreciate being told we could only proceed with iwi approval. Hence, we ask if this should pass, that our land be excluded from the map on the grounds of 151 years of contributions to this community. The actual land was subdivided by the council. Perhaps they'd like to pay the fee. We have also worked in our community. Now, I'm going to have to walk home for telling you this, but it's worth it. This gentleman here has been 60 years a volunteer fireman and 27 years of those as a fire chief. Commitment, dedication to this community, and only many, one of our many family who do so. Queenstown, and like so many others here, we enjoy volunteering. Our community is our family. Ngātahu has a wealthy investment in this town, yet the moment they visualised a loss of income, they closed most of their operations and released their staff. We are and always have been a multicultural town. Now, as we fight hard to rebuild our town and to care for our people so that our Queenstown has a future. Now, as a large business in Queenstown, we see Ngātahu has a role to play, not as a collector of monies, but a group happy to help us build whānau of every culture in Queenstown. Queenstown has always had a caring heart. For Ngātahu to restore mana to our community, it would mean volunteering to share their stories, their history, to the many cultures we have here, so that never again will history not have meaning and will not be recorded. Are there any questions, please? We are in the right, it's not, it's
12
Anderson Heights, lot submission number 3194 and stream 16. It's a residential.
Are we able to call it up? So it's 12 Anderson Heights.
Yes. Yep. It's not a large portion of land, but it's the principle of what they're asking for.
It is in the town, isn't it?
Yes, right, right in town. Yes, central, yeah.
Up on Queenstown Town.
Yes.
Yep.
We got the letter to say it did.
Yes.
That's right. Last week, it was suggested to us that might be pulled back.
We would love it to be pulled back.
As I say, that is what both Kaitahu and the council are recommending to us.
That would be greatly appreciated. There's a lot we've got to do in this town. We want harmony and work. We don't want this derision. It's not nice.
Any other questions?
Is it showing you?
I think they're pulling up the map, but can you just confirm the... You have a... So is it the house block there, or is it a piece of land behind there, backing onto Kerry Road?
Can I speak to that?
It's
the section 12, and it cuts across the corner, and I would imagine there's only about 25, maybe up to 50 square metres of that land that is within the zone. The rest of it is out of the zone, and it could be easy managed to realign the boundary to take that out.
Can you blow that up, please, Kim?
It's just a tiny little corner that comes down from above that slivers onto your property.
Yes.
And I mean, that is something I think we will ask. I will need to ask the council whether that sort of sliver could be amended. It's the one on to there. See the tiny corner?
Yes. Yeah, right, yeah. Very small bit, isn't it?
Any other questions?
Thank you for allowing us to express our thoughts. Have a good day. Thank you.
Representative of the forces of regional government. Oh, I see behind us. Is that Mr. Turner?
Am I unmuted now?
Yes.
Is that okay?
You're good to go. Mr. McLennan, can you speak to us?
Excellent. Thank you. Hello. Yes, my name is Andrew McLennan. I'm a planning consultant acting on behalf of the Otago Regional Council. Thank you very much for accommodating me and avoiding my flight down to Queenstown. As much as I love Queenstown, I'm not going to take you too long, so it's good that I can just take a quick 10-minute break and speak to you all. So ORC submitted on the Wahi Te Puna provisions and also submitted, lodged a further submission, and I have provided evidence on behalf of ORC in relation to the Wahi Te Puna chapter. ORC's submission was largely supportive of the Wahi Te Puna provisions, and it was considered that they give effect to the partially operative Regional Policy Statement 2019. My evidence focused largely on three policies and a few of the rules, namely Rule 39.5.1b, 39.5.2b, 39.5.3b, and also the policies 39.213 and 39.214. I've reviewed the officer's evidence and the changes suggested. In relation to Rule 39.5.1 through 3b, I have reviewed her suggested amendments. The point I was trying to make in my evidence was that when I initially had read the chapter, I didn't, and maybe it was an obvious link I missed, but I missed the link that in Part B, where it talks about activities affecting the water quality are recognised as a threat. I didn't make the link immediately to the threats listed in the schedule. And so my evidence suggested that a reference to that subpoint could be added to make it clear that when they're talking about activities that affect water quality that are recognised as a threat, those are the threats listed in the schedule. So that's one, I suppose, small amendment I would suggest to add clarity to that particular rule. And the same would go for 39.5.3b. It may be that it does seem like without that link, you would still refer to that schedule, but I suppose that would add clarity if it was explicitly referenced within that rule. The other aspect of my evidence related to policies 39.213 and 39.214, ORC's submission sought some amendments to align it with the Regional Policy Statement, namely policy 222 of the Regional Policy Statement, and the reporting officer has largely agreed with the submission of ORC, and I support the suggested amendments within the chapter. My evidence did note that Mr. Bathgate from Kaitahu suggested some amendments which would basically merge policy 39.213 and 39.214. I supported that amendment because I thought it added clarity, particularly to 39.214, as it meant that they could be read together, and the any adverse effect part of that policy would be read in conjunction with the first part of the would be read in conjunction with 39.213, and I thought that added clarity to the drafting. Those are the only suggestions I have, and that's sort of where my evidence finished up. So I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. McLennan. Mr. Cheatham.
Morena, can you hear me all right?
Yes, I can. Morena.
Thanks for that. Just a general comment I would be seeking from you, and that's some submitters are suggesting that the provisions, chapter 39 provisions, go above and beyond what the RPS RPS provisions. And then have you just got a sort of general comment on that?
So I would disagree that they go above and beyond. I suppose my review of the provisions has largely been focused on the objectives and policies, and I haven't gone into the detail of the mapping or site-specific areas. But certainly from an objective and policy level, with the amendments suggested by the reporting officer, I would say that this is largely consistent with what is required by the regional policy statement, and particularly policy 222. There's some reasonably strong direction there about avoiding significant adverse effects on Waitapuna sites. So I think that gives the QLDC and yourselves quite strong direction as to the value of these areas. I would have, when we were doing our submission, I admit I'd be rusty on the details, but yes, I would have looked at that some months ago. It didn't have any red flags for me, but again, I'm talking about months ago since I read it, so I'm cautiously saying yes.
Okay, thanks.
Commissioner Hill.
Thank you, Ms. McLennan. Just, I think one question, might be a couple questions within there. It's to do with your view. It's not so much what's in your evidence, but policy 39215 and 6. Those are the ones which are suggested to encourage consultation with mana whenua, and then sets out when cultural impact assessments may be required. I just wondering about your planning view, whether you think it's better to have those, what I'm calling sort of process or method type policies here, because it's quite clear what's expected, or is it your view that applicants and council should rely on what's in the Act and Schedule 4 about consultation requirements? And of course, there are legally no consultation requirements on resource consent, but when CIA is required, which really does form part of an AUE. So I'm really interested in your view whether those policies are better than here than not.
Yeah, I guess these sorts of policies, from my experience anyway, when you're dealing with sites of cultural significance, having more detail, particularly up front, is beneficial. I suppose in the old versions of plans, usually it's a little bit ad hoc depending on which consent planner you make it. And this is not Queenstown specific, this is, I suppose, nationwide, that you can get a range of different requirements depending on which planner you make it or different councils. So certainly I would support having detail within the policies, as you say, a method-based policy. Just identifying what is the requirement and when it's going to be required. I think certainly the new plans these days, second generation plans, are much more direct as to what's required, and I think that's really good.
Thank you. So better than now. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Commissioner Smith.
Thank you. I just have one question regarding policy 39.2.1.3. You've referred to avoid, remedy, mitigate non-significant adverse effects on identified Waihitapuna areas. I just wonder whether you think it's the areas that we're trying to avoid the effects on, or the values and sites within those areas that we're trying to avoid the effects on.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think certainly it's the value that you're trying to protect. And you do that by, I guess, avoiding, remedying, and mitigating the effects on the area. But yes, certainly it's the values that you're trying to protect. Or in this, protect in this case.
So do you think that the wording of that should be more specific to refer to the values and sites, or do you think that it, we're actually trying to protect the mapped areas, or are we trying to protect the values within that?
Yeah, I think it, I mean, I think it is the values that you're trying to protect, and I'll just. And I suppose the objective you're trying to achieve is that the values held by Mana Whenua are recognised and provided for well, within the identified areas. Mm.
If we're to take the approach that this is the mapping, the identification of the Waihitupuna areas, it's been pretty precautionary or broad brush, and that it's subject to a further level of assessment to identify the values and the sites.
Right.
Yeah, so I'm just trying to work out.
Yeah, I mean, it would seem. I haven't put too much thought into that, but I suppose, and I would expect that the values are the things that you're trying to protect, and so it's the effect on the value you're trying to manage.
Okay, thank you. We might ask the council officer to consider that in their response. Thank you.
No questions, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. McLennan.
And nothing from me. So thank you very much for zooming in, and appreciate your time, Mr. McLennan.
Thank you very much.
Next on the list, and I apologise in advance for my pronunciation, is Brian Cook.
Right click on it. If you right click over the little blue line, yeah. Eject. Shoot. That means. Perfect. Thank you.
Atamare Tenakoto Kotur, I apologize for that delay. And I had partly anticipated the response to my name, which is why after listening to Mr. McLeod's Scottish te reo, which was superb the other day, I have taken the same approach to the approach I took when I was teaching resource management law at Lincoln University in 2015, and I'm not going to attempt more than what you've just heard me say, but I did produce an introduction to myself at the beginning of that course for resource management law, which explains through the use of my husband's name, perhaps a little bit of where I come from, which is the visualization of the phonetic pronunciation of Freinhoch. So my husband, whose nickname is Frey, and I am clearly from the North Island and represent the hook part of the equation. So, and can you hear me? Oh, sorry. Okay.
Sorry, we turned around to read a little read of the PowerPoint.
Well, the rest of the information is irrelevant. Don't worry about that. It was really just the diagrammatic, phonetic.
Thank you.
Of Pine Oak, which was my attempt at a modern mihi, to say, where I come from. I'm happy to take it that my two submissions are read, in which case I also have my, oh no, don't worry about that. I have my annexures in colour with me, if you would like a copy. I wasn't quite sure whether that might be helpful. On the basis that those two submissions are read, perhaps the only thing that might be useful for me would be to draw attention to the difference between the two submissions and our further submission in the alternate, that any values identified on the Esplanade Reserve and private property fringes be limited to a ribbon on the Frankton track with values of Aratafito and Mahika Kai. Further narrative and place names could be added to chapter 39, and we have suggested naming those sections, for example, Tahuna a Te Kirikiri, which would be the section in front of our property. Now, I'm happy to outline the submissions if you wish me to do so, but I'm more than happy for answering questions. I have two further points that I included in my second submission, the first being that the evaluation reports prepared by the QLDC for the purpose of section 32 and section 42A did not quantify the costs of the chapter. And perhaps it's anecdotal evidence, but the depreciation valuation of our vacant site by $300,000 last year was, I can only presume, due to the notification of the chapter. I had a valuation prepared just after the chapter was notified by a government department to settle a long-running dispute that we had been engaged in over the location and trespass of the QODC stormwater drain pipe, and the valuation that we had was based on a contract offer based on the square meter value, and the valuation that we were provided was $300,000 less with no real explanation, because in the interim there had been no lowering in value of the square meter prices of land available in that particular zone. The only other addition I would make to my submission is that in the event that Chapter 39 includes identified threats in the objectives and policies of that chapter, we request that the identified threat of driveways be modified as follows, where it says at E, new roads, additions, alterations to existing roads, vehicle tracks and driveways, I would put in brackets, except where unformed driveways are already created by subdivision.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask if this property can be brought up again on the map? It would be quite helpful if they all are. What's your address?
Well, we are, and I was going to suggest that the second page of my photographs also shows an aerial view that was taken by drone and looks down onto it from the lake above, which makes it quite visible.
What we can get up here, though, and is then the your property overlaying by the Wahitupuna mapping, so we can see.
And then the next photograph after that shows quite as a good starting point to the mapping overlay. Now our property is directly in front of you. It's a vacant site just to the, where was that little There's a very big, large vacant site to the left.
Vacant site. Is that yours?
No, no. The one to the right of that. That.
Next
okay.
To the,
so our two sites are that. The house is the house above in white. You can see a house on the Frankton Road. That's one property, 193 Frankton Road. Then the section below is 197 to 199 Frankton Road. And as I mentioned in my first submission, it's that section that includes the stormwater pipes and then up to where the line has been drawn up and over. And the line that has been drawn for the Wahi Tupuna only just, we might need to go back to the next set of photographs to clearly identify. If we drop down, no, up, sorry. That one, yes. Perhaps, yes. Now you can see a red line. I'm not quite sure whether or not I've got that red line in the right spot. It's more or less. In fact, I think it's too high. The tree at the bottom left of the screen is where the Wahi Tupuna wiggles up and around that tree, because that was that is a boundary tree. I couldn't find the boundary peg when I went down there, but that is the boundary peg. So the line has wiggled up and around what is not an indigenous tree, it's an exotic chestnut tree. So it wiggles up and around that particular line. And that line is an approximation of where the Queenstown sewerage runs, the main sewer line.
So it just clips the bottom of your property?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Yes.
Previous submitter, whether they were aware, you were aware, that both Kaitahu and the council are now recommending that the rules of Chapter 39 not apply to urban zone land.
Well, I was unsure whether urban zone land meant high density residential.
Yes. Any of the residential zones, settlement, business, industrial, the whole lot. Basically, it would have to be rural residential, or rural lifestyle before the rules were covered.
And then my other submission then would apply to the lake, because the bulk of my submission is addressed towards Wakatipuwai Māori, which extends the zoning of Wakatipuwai Māori out past the legal boundary of the lake. And as I mentioned in my earlier submission, the lake has an ambulatory boundary, which is where the first few photographs that I have are relevant. So if the Wahi Tupuna goes up onto the Lake Esplanade Reserve, so Wakatipuwai Māori is zoned rural general, our property is zoned high density residential. In between the two, because I am not adjacent, our properties do not, along Frankton Road, do not sit adjacent to Wakatipuwai Māori. There is an Esplanade Reserve in between. So if Wakatipuwai Māori, with the same name, becomes a new zone, which is enlarged, greater than Wakatipuwai Māori is under the statutory acknowledgement area in the Ngāi Settlement Claims Act, we become adjacent, and therefore consultation would be required on any activities done on my property, whether or not there is a zoning on my property.
I was going to ask you about that, because your point on 95B seems to assume that the Wahi Tupuna areas are statutory acknowledgements. The statutory acknowledgement area hasn't changed.
Well, correct. The statutory acknowledgement area is the lake, Wakatipuwai
yes.
Māori, with a boundary that comes in, if we go back to my first few photographs, with a boundary that in the second, perhaps the second photo, that's it with yellow. Yes, the boundary at its very highest point, I have a red line drawn in the sand down on the beach. Now, it's not often that the water ever gets to that level. In fact, there is generally beach to sit on. But in the last 20 years, occasionally, it does move up quite high. And in the last few years, I think they've resolved problems since the era of the flood. So the lake is generally much lower. So very, very infrequently it can get to the boundary, but not often. So Wakatipu Waimauri, as legally defined in the as a statutory acknowledgement area, is the lake and lake bed out to the ambulatory boundary, which is the average mean high tide of a lake. It's the annual mean. So my evidence is not scientific where I have drawn the lines. It is just my approximation of what I've experienced over the last 20 years living on at 193.
I suppose my point is that the fact that there's a wide Tupuna overlay doesn't shift that statutory acknowledgement boundary. If you're not currently adjacent to a statutory acknowledgement boundary, you won't be adjacent to one because of the Waiatupuna overlay.
But if the Waiatupuna overlay comes out to the over the Esplanade Reserve, out to our cadastral boundaries, I am adjacent to the Waiatupuna.
But Section 95B says if you're adjacent to a statutory acknowledgement area, the Waiatupuna area is not a statutory acknowledgement area.
Correct.
So I can't understand why the Waiatupuna area, you think the Waiatupuna area will alter your position vis-a-vis notification in terms of Section 95B. That's what I'm struggling with.
Okay. So, you know. Well, when I looked at it, I was uncertain of the wording, and it felt to me that it could be interpreted that way. And over time, because Wakatipu Waimauri has the same name and the Waiatupuna name of that particular site, 33, is the same, I felt it might just merge into one. I'm also relying on Mr. Devlin's evidence that I've just seen as a planner, and he seemed to be of the same opinion. So I defer to his evidence there.
Well, certainly I'd be interested to talk to Mr. Devlin about. The other thing I wanted to mention to you was you querying at the start of your second submission whether you can add in Lake Hallis Mooring Company Limited. The answer is that would be a major drama.
Okay.
That you would need to make formal application to lodge a late submission, which would need to be notified in order that further submissions. And since we have actually started the hearing, that would be something of a problem. So as I say, if you want to make a formal application, you can do so, but I suggest you do it in writing.
Okay.
But as I say, the paraphrase would be, you're going to need some really good reasons because it's obviously late and it will disrupt the process.
I understand that. It was really supplementary to my assertion that the process and notification had not been fair, and that anyone with a resource consent on the lake perhaps should have been notified.
Thank you. Question 2.
Can you just in your second paragraph of your legal submission? Sort of the last couple of sentences says QLDC has failed to actually identify any significant sites. You've got quotation marks around that. What would be your definition? Are you utilising a particular definition of significant sites there? Are you referring to?
I'm referring to the policy for the protection mechanism in identifying significant sites for settlement of Crown lands. I suppose the significant site policy was a significant policy change in New Zealand's history following the decision to abandon Section 27A memorials for SOE land. And that was the policy framework that I was involved in. And significant sites has sort of taken on a particular term through that process. Under that government process, Waihitapu sites can be identified as being significant sites, and through their identification they have been able to be put to one side for settlement purposes. So rather than entering the land bank for an envelope settlement process, Waitapu sites have been able to be identified where claimants had a Waitangi Tribunal claim and set to one side and used for settlement and returned to the respective iwi or hapu groups outside of the settlement envelope. I suppose further to that is the fact that there has been no case law that I could find in my early days of looking, because unfortunately we went into lockdown and I had no database access outside of the law library, which was closed. So there has been no Wahitapuna discussed in environmental case law, only Wahitapu.
But essentially what you're saying is that with regard to the framework you've just mentioned,
these sites don't qualify, and
they don't
appear to qualify as significant sites. They're not nationally significant. They haven't been identified as Wahitapu.
Sorry, I haven't quite seen your annexure, but that policy framework is not doesn't fall within the RMA framework.
Well, it does in the sense that the Resource Management Act relies in part two on sections 5, 6, 7, and 8. So in terms of what government good faith obligations are under the Treaty of Waitangi, I'm saying that the Queenstown Lakes District Council has overachieved in a sense. They have gone broader than actual obligations under the Treaty of Waitangi. So really the framework for the Waitapuna needs to be looked at in terms of obligations under Section 6 and Section 7, but is certainly much broader than what is legally required of government or local government representatives under the Treaty of Waitangi Clause.
Thank you very much for your time. It's much appreciated, and particularly for the photos, they're really good and easy and helpful to understand.
Morning.
Morning, Mr. Clark.
I've never appeared in one of these before, so I'm going to read it. You'll have to excuse me. There's not a lot of points that you have to worry about, because this is a submission from my heart. Okay, my name is Nick Clark. My wife and I brought our land at Closeburn in 1975. We built our house in 1980, and we still live there. We have raised our three children there and now have a third generation living on our property. A fourth, my mother included, before that. I have been a field worker ranger for the Lands and Survey and the Department of Conservation in this area for the past 39 years. I've spent my entire working career developing and maintaining recreational facilities in the Wakatipu Basin, from the head of a lake, Mount Aspiring, to Kingston, from Skippers to the Kawara Gorge. I have a love and a deep respect for the Wakatipu Basin, which I call home. Our property, now part of number 16 Punatapu area, has been transformed over the last 40 years from 15 acres of wilding pines and scrub to a mainly indigenous flora and fauna, with huge increase in native birds due to our best pest controlled. We're extremely proud and protective of it. I've asked to speak at this hearing because I strongly oppose the blanket coverage of large blocks of private land under the proposed Wahitupuna section of the proposed district plan. The Ngāi Tahu claims, settled in 1988, is a long list of claims made by Ngāi Tahu. I have them here on the back. Since 1849 they started. 1870, some claims were upheld, but not too much compensation came forth. In 1906, the South Island Landless Native Act was signed off. In 1921, £354,000 was offered to Ngāi Tahu, which they rejected. In 1921, they were offered £10,000. It is a perpetual payment annually. In 1992, they claimed the fisheries. And in 1998, $170 million was given under the Ngāi Tahu land settlement, full and final. Sir Tipene O'Regan stated that the claim would not be on private land. Full and final means just that. As far as I'm concerned, Ngāi Tahu cannot keep coming back, making claim after claim. Sorry, I'm talking too loud. Claim after claim, just to generate a source of income. Because that's what it looks like to me. The moment I say I want to do something on my land, hold it, it's my private land. You say, hold on, we'll get our planners to come and check it out. It could take a couple of months holding you up on any consent that you want. We may find something of significance, may it be physical or non-physical, but it will cost you. The moment you do that, charge me, you lose credibility. You are not a territorial authority. You do not have the right to charge me. There is no avenue of recourse as there is with a local government. It is wrong. Why don't you do it out of your deep concern for your heritage without costing me money? Sarah Pickard in S42A 5.7 quotes, "The effects on cultural values are not limited to physical effects, and in some instances, adverse effects on cultural values may also be non-physical." What about my cultural values and my non-physical values? Freehold title is the highest form of landship ownership in New Zealand after the Crown's. It is also the most common. As the registered proprietor, I own the underlying land and the dwellings on it. My wife and I strongly believe we as the holders are the caretakers of this land, and I want to hand it on to our children and to their children if they so choose to, unencumbered by Ngāi Tahu, who can't even tell me what their values are, apart from the fact that they want to charge me big dollars while they think about what cultural values may be on my land. Therefore, I recommend that the blanket Wahitupuna coverage in the proposed plan be scrapped and the 45 known sites be identified. If some are on private land, management plans are set up and dealt with. There is no evidence of any sites on my land. Can I just highlight another concern of mine? QLDC planners rejected or partially rejected 99% of the public submissions. Sarah Pickard, in her report, states that earthworks have raised the most opposition in terms of submissions. No kidding there. Can I read you paragraph 5-6? And excuse me if I misinterpret this, I will accept correction at a later point. If permitted volume limits of earthworks in the various zones were applied, that is the in section 25, Chapter 25, sorry, within the Wahitupuna overlay, this could result in a significant increase in the permitted earthwork volume compared to the 10 cubic metres as notified. It can't increase past the 400, which is on our rural lifestyle blocks. And of course it will increase if it's reduced to 10 cubic metres. 5.8, an increase in the volume of earthworks permitted would reduce the number of resource consents required, therefore reducing the potential cost of consultation. We are not asking for the volume to be increased. We want it to stay the same as it is in Chapter 25, 400 cubic metres. Volume 5.8, point 5.8 should read, if we decrease the volume, this would increase the number of resource consents, decrease it from 10 to 4, and increase the costs. We don't want that. The wording has put a negative slant on staying with the existing Chapter 25 conditions. I have an issue with how this proposal, the Waihatupuna proposal, has been drafted. Kaitahu's commercial consultancy firm have had a huge influence over the direction it should go. They've possibly even written it and given it to QLDC. But the first we heard about it as ratepayers was in September 2019. One would have hoped that those employed as public servants in QLDC would be looking after our best interests, but I'm afraid this has not been the case. We've been sold down the road extremely well and are now fighting for our rights as ratepayers and private landholders. Finally, I would invite any Ngāi Tahu, if they're present today, whatever, to come to my land, to come to our property. Don't bring your properties. Don't bring your invoice book. I don't have an FPOS in my property. And I don't want bureaucrats present when I'm discussing things of the heart. They would not understand. We can wander around the hillside, find some artifacts, maybe, find something of significance. I can show you where my mother's ashes are scattered. And I can tell you, and you can tell me why your ancestors would have dragged their walkers 4.5 kilometres up from Bob's Cove to my place on a hillside. We can have a cup of tea, we can have a chat, we can talk about things, and hopefully we can part a little more tolerant of one another's aspirations. Thank you. Any questions? It's in the Closeburn subdivision.
What's the address?
Lot 24.
Do you have a street number?
Street number?
664C.
Closeburn Road.
Closeburn Road.
Do you know the elevation of your property?
The lake's about 3.1. We're about 100 metres up above that, so it'll be about 400 metres. One of those long, skinny ones.
And is it a rural lifestyle zone?
The rural lifestyle. It has three zonings on it. I think it's got an exclusion zone, a rural lifestyle, and something else.
Rural.
Exclusion.
Can you zoom out so we can get a fix on? So there's the lake edge. Now go back in. So it's one of those.
Yep.
Long, thin ones.
Mr. Yep. Clark. Yes, it's the 1, 2, 3, 4th or 5th one in from the left.
Okay.
Lot 24.
That's it.
It's definitely in the Wahitapuna zone, don't worry.
Oh, yes. We can see it. It's about 70 or 80% covered. Is the property sloping
than... It's vertical, nearly. Yeah.
Yes, I was wondering about that. So down by the Closebring Road.
Yes.
Presumably there's a platform on the road, and then it goes skyward from there.
It goes skyward from the road. There was a platform, a platform up where our section was. I have recently gone through subdivision, and my son has a house on it now. That's not gone through yet because he hasn't completed all the consent requirements, i.e. sealing the bottom half of the road and putting his fire tank in and stuff like that. So it will be cut into three, hopefully, before this carry-on gets over.
Referring to when you mentioned identification of 45 individual sites.
I believe somewhere in the original Waitapuna thing that was put out, that it mentioned 45 sites.
Yes, so that's the 45.
Yeah, or any. I don't have any problem, and I'm
so
sure most people don't have any.
This is one of them.
Sorry?
This overlay we're looking at now is one of the 45.
The whole site. Is no, I'm talking about sites of significance, like food pits where artifacts have been found. I'm not saying I thought that was one of the 45 sites, but the guy Glover said previously, a couple of back, said there were 30 sites up in the Glenorchy area. I just have difficulty with the. If you want to come onto my land and you can find a food pit or something like that, I will respect that. I won't touch it. But when it comes to non-spiritual things, you want to come in and say, well, you know, so there's something going on here. I don't know. I mean, I cannot get my head around that. I just don't understand how you can charge me for something that's non-physical, that's spiritual. Good.
Yes, Sam, I have no questions, but thanks for your contribution to the recreational facilities and to your passion for this place.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Thanks, Mr. Clark. Much appreciated.
Good morning. I'll start off by apologising because I've overcommitted myself this morning and I do have to leave at 10:30. I'm in your hands. I can come back later today, or as you know, I'm back here tomorrow for 2 hours and can pick up any points. But the upside of that is that Wayfair have instructed me on a very narrow basis in terms of what they want me to emphasise today. And they are points that overlap with the more detailed submissions for our other clients tomorrow.
I think probably the best way forward is if you take us through this submission, we have time to ask questions about it, but if we don't, we'll pick them up tomorrow.
Thank you very much.
Rather than ask them to come back this afternoon and then come back tomorrow.
Thank you very much.
For a rehash or a larger rehash.
Yes.
All
of that. And, And Mr. Farrell's big enough to look after himself without me as well.
Yeah, I'm not Mr. Farrell can cope on it. I'm not sure I'd let him out.
Thank you very much, Chair. So the two points that I pick up from the submissions that we're prepared for tomorrow's group of clients, and one relates to Section 87BB, and I understand there's been some discussion generally about you know, whether it's possible to frame a permitted activity pathway if the APA from the appropriate entity has been provided, or something along those lines. Now, as like you, I'm familiar with the case law that generally leaving discretion to a third party is not a valid permitted activity rule. But what I've tried to look at, in case there's a new way forwards, and I'm not saying that there necessarily is because it's untested as far as our research can tell, is whether through 87BB and prescription in the plan of what a marginal non-compliance constitutes in this context, there is possibly an opportunity for an efficient approval pathway using that. Now, this is something that, because it's novel, would maybe require some more conversation and dialogue with Council's team and Ngāi Tahu's team, and we're very open to that. So really this is partly to plant the seed in the collective wisdom on the panel to see where your thinking takes you on that point. So that's my first point to emphasise, and Mr. Farrell picks up on that as well in his evidence. And the other point is really, again, a theme that Mr. Farrell's quite fond of, which is the importance of the planning architecture really lining up and integrating with these important provisions, where they best fit in the planning architecture, and how they can then, in a consenting sense, be dealt with as efficiently and effectively as possible. And so, as you know, this is the third stage of the plan, and the fact that this unfortunately has come at stage three means there's at this stage still a lack of integration and lack of decent streamlining of these provisions with the existing chapters. Both Mr. Farrell and Mr. Devlin both can see how these provisions could have the same effect but at existing stage one chapters of the plan. So hopefully you're already live to thinking about that. But in my paragraph four of my synopsis, I also just draw your attention to, and hopefully the Council's attention to, an additional work stream that's being undertaken following the Environment Court's Topic 2 decision on landscape. So the Environment Court directed planner and landscape caucusing to come up with a values identification framework for important and outstanding landscapes. That caucusing is still yet to take place, but it's obvious that part of that values identification framework will significantly overlap with a lot of the values in the Wāhi Tupuna. And so just again, in terms of that planning architecture and integration and efficiency, I think we all need to be live to the best way to integrate the outcomes of this hearing process along with the existing stage one chapters and the values identification framework that will eventually be part of the plan architecture as well in a landscape context. So like I say, we're here to help the conversation. We haven't come up with the elegant solution because this is important and difficult. We've come up with some solutions to consider, but there will be others in the collective wisdom that are out there to throw around, and it could be that you might find that further discussions between the parties and the council was helpful to help you make your final decision.
What I'll be interested in discussing with you tomorrow, since I'm sitting staring at 87BB scratching my head, is whether we're talking, when we talk about the rules, whether those are marginal or temporary non-compliance with requirements, conditions and permissions, and how you would in fact know in advance they were marginal or temporary.
Well, that's what I've been playing with, is if an applicant went to Okaha and got an APA and then came to council and said, yes, my activity technically, well, actually more than technically, properly breaches this rule, but here's Okaha's affected party approval, does that constitute me being brought down to the level of a marginal non-compliance? It's a sort of a two-step process, and that's what we've been looking at, whether or not that's a lawful approach or not.
Okay, and possible. I'll think about that before tomorrow.
Yep, good.
That's a lengthy discussion. And presumably, I should talk to Mr. Farrell about his integration issues.
So I do have 10 minutes, so I'm happy to take questions in the meantime.
Just in relation to this values identification work that the Environment Court's sending people off to do,
mm-hmm.
My understanding is that only relates to outstanding natural landscapes. It doesn't relate to the RCLs.
The RCLs. I think you're right. I'll check that for tomorrow.
So presumably one couldn't say that Wahi Tupuna and ONLs are constantly...
Correct. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
or 8 minutes.
Yeah.
The second point is any adverse, second requirement, any adverse environment effect no different in character, intensity, and scale than they would be in the absence of the marginal and temporary non-compliance.
Mm.
Is that ever going to be the case?
Even if you have an APA?
Yes.
Well, that's the thing. If you've got an APA, those effects under section 104 can't be taken into account. So
yes, but that's in the decision as
of
to
a of a consent. Yes, that's right.
It doesn't mean that they don't exist for all.
That's I agree. It's not an elegant fit. But what we've been trying to look at is an effective way of ensuring the appropriate runanga are engaged with. Because that's obviously one of the main objectives is engagement at the right time, as well as efficient as possible approval or consenting pathway for the applicant.
I suppose the one way forward would be if you have an APA, that would certainly be good for the purposes of a notification.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So you might not be permitted.
That's right, yeah, in that sense, yes.
I suppose my reaction is you're going to have to try hard. I'm dubious.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Not unconvinced, but dubious.
Mm. Be back
tomorrow.
Yeah, with some more time.
I'll wait tomorrow. Mr. Farrell.
Morena.
Before Mrs. Baker Galloway does a runner,
yes.
I think she needs to make an application for us to receive this.
Oh, right. I seek leave for a summary that's two. Is it two pages over? One and a half page over.
Yes, five pages. We can exclude the front page.
Yes.
Page here and there. I suppose
got very generous margins and line spacing as well.
As long as I can be assured this is not a precedent for your subsequent witnesses.
No, not at all.
Therefore, I will not not sure I would attend.
No, I give you a complete undertaking that will not happen.
To be fair to Ms. Baker, it's just all my responsibility of liaising with the council. So.
Well, in that case, I think we might, before you read this, I think we might have a cup of tea.
Mm, here we go.
Among other things, I want to read it before go and think about it. So we'll adjourn and be back at 20 to 11.
Thank you.
Thank you.
See you tomorrow.
Tomorrow.